As we continue with this 2 Samuel chapter 22 lesson, we're going to start at verse 29 tonight. And like last time, we're going to do this in small chunks because this is a very long chapter. And there's a number of important implications and applications in this week's study I think you're going to enjoy. Now, to get our feet set for tonight, let's talk for a moment about what we saw occurring in this Psalm of Thanksgiving that is essentially chapter 22 that we've been reading in the preceding verses. And our attention is focused on David's words that he viewed himself as essentially meriting God's deliverance as a reward for his good and faithful behavior towards God. God says that David says he's being recompensed by Jehovah for his tzedakah, his righteous deeds. And that this is proved by having kept himself from avon. Our complete Jewish Bible says sin. It more means guilt or depravity. And we have to look back no further than 2 Samuel chapter 12 to see that David's high opinion of himself and feeling that whatever he has done must have been relatively minor is not justifiable. Because in chapter 12, the prophet Nathan brings God's oracle of curse upon David and all of his household for the terrible evil that David has done, mostly centering on his illicit affair with a married woman, Bathsheba, and then the murder of her husband, Uriah, to cover it all up. And as we discussed last time, rabbis would take me to task for this viewpoint, since they say that David's claim of purity and innocence is true, because he never committed as much as a single trespass against the Lord and the Torah law. Christian scholarship, on the other hand, is generally mute on the subject. Or at least it doesn't directly challenge David's assertion of sinlessness. If Christian commentators do discuss it, often their position is that this is David speaking of a higher, more ethereal kind of spiritual innocence that a believer receives once we accept our salvation. That is, we're forgiven for our sins, so God doesn't see our sinful condition any longer. Now, those typical positions can only be upheld by applying very liberal amounts of allegorical interpretation to these scripture passages and by reading modern church doctrines backwards into the Old Testament accounts. There is no mention, any kind of implication in this Song of David formerly committing sins but now having those sins forgiven. Even the rabbis admit that David is boldly saying his behavior has been flawless. So, this is not an issue of deliverance from sins, but rather a deliverance from earthly enemies and from foreign governments. So it seems to me that we need to accept, as unsavory as it is, that David is merely boasting. And he has a seriously distorted view of his own life and of his own behavior before the Lord. He seems to have forgotten that Jehovah saved him for a purpose greater than himself. That the several deliverances that he experienced were acts of pure divine grace. And they were based on a promise that God made to David and to his offspring. And because the Father is always faithful to his word, David was delivered time after time after time. Merit played no role or issue in this at all. Let's read a little bit more of 2 Samuel chapter 22. We're going to start at verse 29. Just read three or four verses. 2 Samuel chapter 22, if you have a complete Jewish Bible, is page 360. I'm going to start at 29 and go through 32. For you, Adonai, are my lamp. Adonai lights up my darkness. With you, I can run through a whole troop of men. With my God, I can leave a wall. As for God, his way is perfect. The word of Adonai has been tested by fire. He shields all who take refuge in him. For who is God but Adonai, and who is a rock but our God? This verse begins an explanation of the kind of help that David received in times past, and he would continue to receive it, from the Lord as he confronts Israel's enemies. And first is his deliverance from darkness. Now, in Bible, darkness always indicates obscurity and blindness. So a lamp and illumination indicates truth and deliverance and salvation. David says that Jehovah God, he is the source of illumination. He is the lamp. And therefore, he gives deliverance from the darkness. He injects truth into obscurity. Now, the Hebrew word used here for darkness is choshek. And choshek carries with it this sense of spiritual darkness, of evil, as opposed to the mere absence of light, such as is normal at nighttime, which in Hebrew is layil. It is this same word for darkness that we find in the Exodus account of this terrifying darkness that supernaturally fell over Egypt in order to bring about the release of God's people from their bondage. So we are to understand that this verse connects with verse 28 that says that God saves his afflicted people, or in Hebrew, God's afflicted Am. David is part of that afflicted Am, and since it pleased the Lord to save David, the Lord gave David power over all of God's and therefore Israel's enemies. But this also deals with David's state of mind. David was known to become depressed when things went badly for him. And we are given plenty of evidence of these episodes of depression in his many psalms, pleading for Jehovah to rescue him. So the statement includes the reality that the Lord has lifted David's mental darkness, his depression. Now let me pause to remind us of a God principle. God delivers his people. He doesn't deliver those who aren't his. That doesn't mean that he doesn't communicate with people who are not his, nor does it mean that he might not help a non-believer in their distress if it suits some larger divine purpose. I also want to say something else to you. This mental darkness, this depression that David was suffering, was what I would call a normal kind of depression. That is to say that when we have something overwhelming or unbelievably tragic happen to us, it's humanly normal to be depressed for a time over it. David wasn't suffering from depression that rose to the level of emotional or mental illness, but he was in a dark place, as he was occasionally in fear for his life, or maybe he was about to lose his kingdom to rebellion, or he was in danger of losing a battle to an enemy. The antithesis of David's depressions is demonstrated in King Saul. King Saul seems to have suffered from mental illness, from an abnormal kind, from an abnormal level of depression that also seems to have led to an irrational paranoia. I would argue that Saul's depression was from a spiritual source. He rebelled strongly against God. God left him, and it led him into a kind of insanity. God did not deliver Saul from his depression that was due to Saul's sin and blasphemy, because in the Lord's eyes, Saul was no longer part of God's Am. He was no longer one of God's people. Of course, God can, it often pleases him, to deliver his redeemed from mental illness. I personally know of such cases. I am by no means an expert on such a debilitating disease as mental illness, but I do know that while some might be caused by spiritual influences, not all of it is. Further, it's true that both God's people and those who are not His can suffer from mental illness, from depression. I've known a number of believers who've dealt with depression, and they often worry needlessly, I think, that it's insufficient faith on their part that has caused these recurring bouts of depression. I don't believe that. Or just as common, that in the loss of a loved one or in some terrible setback of some kind, loss of a job, a financial calamity, that they can't shake their depression, and so they think they have a damaged relationship with God. I don't make that connection. It's kind of the other side of the prosperity doctrine. That doctrine that says if you have enough faith, you'll be rich and happy. If you don't, you'll be poor and sad. And that is simply a false doctrine that is of itself, has of itself oppressed many folks. King David was as mentally tough as it gets. And let me tell you something else. He was as loved of God as it gets. And even he suffered terrible setbacks. Had depression for extended periods of time. But what he knew to do was to cry out to God. Then God would come to his aid. We have to do the same. But we also must be aware that sometimes depression is a legitimate medical condition that needs treatment. And it needs treatment sometimes with medicine as well as with prayer. There's no shame in it. And there is certainly no condemnation from the Lord implied in that kind of a circumstance. Well, then in verse 32, we get a reminder of what we discussed in a previous lesson about David's and Israel's cultural understanding of God. The rhetorical question is asked, well, who is God but Adonai? But what it says in Hebrew is, who is El but Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh? Who is El but Yehovah? So what David is saying is that Yehovah, Yahweh, is Israel's El. Israel's El, Israel's highest God. And in fact, Yehovah is the ultimate El. And this connects back to verse 14, where David refers to Yehovah as Ha-Elyon, the highest El. Now, if you weren't here, you've forgotten our discussion of Ha-Elyon and the meaning of El in those times, then you're going to have to go back and review lesson 34, last week's lessons. But there's yet another application for us in our day. God is Yehovah, or Yahweh, the God of Israel. God is not Allah. God is not Buddha. God is not Hindi. God is not the old man upstairs. God is not the generic intelligence of the universe. He is not an unnamed God, and he's not the interfaith God. God is one. He is Echad. He is holy. There is one God. His name is Yehovah, and he is the God of the Bible, and there is no other. Praying to Allah is not unknowingly praying to Jesus, as many Christian denominations now claim. It's unknowingly praying to nothing. Let's move on. Samuel, 2 Samuel 22, 33 through 37. God is my strength and protection. He makes my way go straight. He makes me swift and sure-footed as a deer. He enables me to stand on my high places. He trains my hands for war until my arms can bend a bow of bronze. You give me your shield, which is salvation. Your answers make me great. You lengthen the steps I can take, yet my ankles do not turn. Yahweh is pictured here as an impenetrable place of sanctuary for David, for all who are God's people. Oh, I love that picture. An impenetrable place of sanctuary. But the next stanza says something that we read occasionally in the Bible, and it's usually misunderstood. It is that God makes my way go straight. My way does not mean the path that lies in front of me. It does not mean my direction. It means my manner, my behavior. That is, the Lord teaches us His way so that we adopt His ways as our ways. And such is the way of truth. In biblical terms, straight means to be true. It means there's no deception. There's no fault in it. The Lord also makes David's feet swift as a deer, a hind, so that he can outrun his enemies either to escape them or to overtake them. And these same swift feet, they take David to his high places. The Hebrew term for high place is bema, bema. It's a religious holy site. It's a place where God dwells. So why does David refer to the place where God dwells as my, meaning David's, high place? It is because all nations had their high places for their gods. David is saying that the Lord gave him swift feet to run to Yahweh, the high place where David's God dwells, as opposed to running to some other high place to beseech some other god. That David was a great warrior is probably how he's best remembered. And no doubt, his days on the victorious battlefield is something that David fondly remembered in his old age. Thus, in verse 35, David credits the Lord for showing him how to fight holy war. And the Lord also gives David the strength to wield weapons in a way that the enemy cannot. And so he uses the metaphor of bending a bow, not made out of supple wood, but out of rigid metal, bronze. A metal bow stores a lot more energy than a wooden bow, and so it's far deadlier when it's unleashed. On the other hand, it is the rare warrior who has the wherewithal to operate such a formidable weapon. Holy Scriptures tell us that prayer is perhaps our strongest weapon in this world. Prayer is our connection to the source of whatever power and might we might have. So when prayer is used by a prayer warrior of the God of Israel, and he or she is trained up in prayer and knows how to pray, it's a most awesome weapon. It's like a bronze bow. However, for the person who doesn't really know God, who doesn't understand the power of prayer, who doesn't know how to pray in God's will, it's a much less effective weapon. It's more like a weak wood bow. So then, verse, complete Jewish Bible, in verse 36, I think makes a wonderful translation of it. Whereas most Bibles will say that you, God, give to me the shield of salvation, the complete Jewish Bible says that you give me your shield, which is salvation. Just as prayer is our powerful bow of bronze, but it's only fully useful in the hands of a trained prayer warrior, so is our salvation in Yeshua, in Jesus Christ, our shield from the arrows that are shot at us by our enemy, Satan, and whomever he might be using to attack us. But that shield can't be conjured up by us. We can't merit it. We can't even design it. We can't work up enough faith inside of us to manufacture it. This shield is given to us from afar, It's a gift. It's a gift from God. It's been transported through time and space to benefit us, and it's only available from Him. That's our shield, which is salvation. Let's read a little bit more of 2 Samuel, and starting at verse 38 and going through 49. I pursued my enemies and wiped them out without turning back until they were destroyed. I destroyed them, crushed them. They can't get up. They've fallen under my feet. For you braced me with strength for the battle, bent down my adversaries beneath me. You made my enemies turn their backs in flight so that I could destroy those who hate me. They looked, but there was no one to help, even to Adonai, but he didn't answer. I pulverized them like dust on the ground, pounded, stamped on them like mud in the streets. You also freed me from the quarrels of my people. You kept me to be the head of the nations. A people I did not know now serve me. Foreigners come cringing to me. The moment they hear of me, they obey me. Foreigners lose heart as they stagger from their fortress. Adonai is alive. Blessed is my rock. Exalted be God, the rock of my salvation, the God who gives me vengeance and makes peoples submit to me. He brings me out from my enemies. You raise me over those who rebel against me. You rescue me from violent men. All of these verses are referring to holy war. I want to recall for you that the holy war that began with Joshua was never successfully completed. The goal was to rid God's kingdom, the promised land, of those who didn't belong there. And who didn't belong there was all who didn't wholeheartedly worship Him. It was not a requirement that all the Canaanites be killed. If they were only driven out of the land, that was acceptable to God. The Lord's preference was for the Canaanites to give up their wicked false gods and instead worship the God of Israel, which essentially changed their identity from Canaanites to Israelites. But forced conversion was never contemplated. Any conversion was to be modeled after Rahab, Rahav, that harlot innkeeper of Jericho, who witnessed the power of the God of Israel, and so she gave her trust to Him by her own free will. She says, that's my God. That's the God I want. The only Canaanites to be killed were those who did not choose to worship Jehovah, and instead of leaving now, they stood and fought. And as a parenthesis, because it's so often overlooked, the only place on the whole earth that was under those holy war instructions was Canaan, the promised land. The other nations of the earth were in no physical danger from Israel. God didn't tell Israel, go conquer the whole Middle East. This was a very limited holy war, limited to the promised land, but it was also an uncompleted holy war. So the elements of the holy war continued on in David's day. And since David was committed to this holy war, God equipped him for it. David speaks not of partial victories, but overwhelming victories. When he repeatedly uses the term I, he indeed sees himself as the victor. On the other hand, verse 40 begins, "For you braced me with the strength for battle, and you bent down my adversaries beneath me." In other words, David fought the battle with zeal and with skill, but in some new supernatural way, the Lord handed the enemy over to David, so the victory was a foregone conclusion before it ever began. I think Christians may have more trouble with this particular concept than maybe any other. We don't know how to view or to characterize our participation in the things we do for the Lord. Therefore, sometimes some people are nearly 100% passive. And they think that we need to kind of sit on our hands and just simply wait for the Lord to supernaturally cause something to happen in our presence so that we do nothing, and by that we can give all credit to him. Others are nearly 100% active. And they think we're to run around frenetically shaking the handle on every door until one finally opens, or even knocking the door down if the handle didn't work very well. And then flying through it as if we're a bull on our way towards a red flag. The red flag being that task or that goal we think the Lord has put before us. Some believers are so reluctant to speak of their participation in a ministry or a mission that all they can speak of is the Lord doing this and the Lord doing that, as though their involvement is incidental or it's meaningless. Others are so caught up in doing that all they can speak of is that I did this and I did that for God, as though God is kind of a junior partner in this whole thing. In some ways, David may have given us a pretty fair model of how to think in a practical way about our participation in a godly endeavor. And it is certainly not as equal partners, but it is as a cooperative venture. We have our part, God has his part, but we are nothing but the tool in the hands of the Master. A tool that remains at rest, safely tucked away in a toolbox, is completely useless. But a tool that tries to operate without its master guiding it is directionless. It may be used for the wrong purpose, and it can even be destructive. David is not afraid to express his activities and his successes and to feel good and fulfilled about them, but it is invariably spoken of in the context of the Lord providing not only the purpose and the means, but the victory itself in a very real way. Now, verse 42 is quite interesting because it expresses the reality that the enemy who looks to their gods for help looks to an empty suit. The lights might be on, but there's nobody home. Therefore, to seek their gods for victory is pointless. On the other hand, the enemy of Israel cannot hope to approach Israel's God because they know of his power and then expect help from him. They can thrust their hands into the air and yell, "Lord, Lord," but he will respond, "I don't know you." I think we need to understand how real and tangible this is to David, even though when we read this ancient verse, it sounds more like a great parable or a wonderfully pious saying to us 21st century Christians. Since everyone in that era believed that there were many gods, it was common to acknowledge even your enemy's gods. Some made it their business to know another nation's gods very well, to know their names, to know their functions, what pleased them, what didn't please them, and so on. And this is because the general belief was that if you called on a god or a goddess by their proper name, and then you asked them for something within their proper function, and if you did so respectfully and perhaps brought the proper gift of appeasement, then you could win that God's favor. So when David says Jehovah pays no attention to Israel's enemies and that he will never aid that enemy, no matter what they may promise to him, it's a great comfort and assurance for David. But David also says in verse 44 that the Lord palat David from the reev of the Am. That is, God delivered David from his disputes with the congregation of Israel. This is speaking of Jehovah delivering David not just from foreign powers, but from internal Israelite rivals, and from domestic issues, from other Hebrews, such as Saul, Ahithophel, his son, Absalom, Ishbosheth, Abner, a whole host of others, all Hebrews. Interestingly, it seems as though David sees his dominion over his own people as a prelude, a first step to his dominion over the nations, the Goyim, the Gentiles. Doesn't that sound familiar? Listen to Romans 1:16. For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believes, but to the Jew first, then to the Greek. Verse 45 relates to this concept, but it's a difficult translation, so nearly every Bible version says it a little bit differently. The complete Jewish Bible speaks of the foreigners who cringe before King David, but then they obey him in fear. The King James Version says that the moment that foreigners hear of David, they submit to him. The NAS says that foreigners pretend to be obedient, but the minute David appears, they properly obey. And on it goes. All kinds of variations. The rabbis long ago dealt with this passage, and I think they have it right. They say it is explaining that non-Israelites, non-worshippers of Yehovah, fear David. So they conceal the truth of what it is they really believe, what it is they really harbor in their hearts, or do so because they fear it will displease David if he ever finds out. They will lie. They will deny that they actually took up arms in war or were merely against David. In other words, many Gentiles will say, oh, I believe in the God of Israel. And I'm for Israel and for David. But it's only because they don't want to be harmed. But David and Israel's power is so great, it's so fearsome, that they only come trembling out of their fortresses to pay homage to this powerful king over God's kingdom so that they're not killed. There's no real allegiance here. So after David recognizes that all of these wonderful things have happened, and he's really amazed by it all, he again understands that this is a cooperative venture led by the steady and the irresistible hand of his master. So in verse 47, David offers a praise of thanksgiving to the God of Israel who has given David the power to accomplish such unlikely things and to deliver David from the hand of the enemy when at times it seemed absolutely impossible that he could survive. And that God even raised David up over those, probably Hebrews, who were rebelling against him. Okay, let's read 2 Samuel, starting at verse 22, verse 50 to the end. So he concludes this psalm with this. So I give thanks to you, Adonai, among the nations. I sing praises to your name. He is a tower of salvation for his king. He displays grace to his anointed, to David, and to his descendants forever. I just love verse 50. Essentially, the psalmist says that the grace that God showered upon David was so complete, it was so awesome, that the praises for the Lord for it couldn't be restricted or contained only to Israel. It had to be raised up by the Gentile nations as well. This is a classic case of a prophecy happening in one sense at a certain time, then happening again in a higher and greater sense. It repeats itself. David conquered Gentile nations, and with that, the knowledge of the God of Israel spread. And so, therefore, did the praises lifted up to God spread. But in a later time, a royal descendant from David, the Messiah, he will bring about the same, only far greater. The anointed king of Israel, whose deliverance the Lord had used so mightily in ancient times, in the larger sense, was not about David as an individual, but really it was rather all about David's forever seed that would culminate with Christ. Let's move on to chapter 23. Chapter 23. We're just going to read the first seven verses of 2 Samuel chapter 23. Page 362 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Here are David's last words. This is the speech of David, the son of Yishai of Jesse, the speech of the man who has been raised up, the one that was anointed by the God of Jacob, the sweet singer of Israel. The Spirit of Adonai spoke through me. His word was on my tongue. The God of Israel spoke. The Rock of Israel said to me, a ruler over people must be upright, ruling in the fear of God. Like the morning light at sunrise on a cloudless day that makes the grass on the earth sparkle after a rain. For my house stands firm with God. He made an everlasting covenant with me. It is in order, fully assured, that he will bring to full growth all my salvation and every desire. But the ungodly are like thorn bushes to be pushed aside, every one of them. They can't be taken in one's hand. To touch them, one uses a pitchfork or a spear shaft, and then it's only to burn them where they lie. This song of David that forms the first seven verses of chapter 23 is usually referred to as David's last words. However, that is by no means actually the case. We have recorded in 1 Kings chapter 2 a deathbed speech to Solomon, whereby David gives his son some admonitions and some instructions, some of them, by the way, concerning some unfinished vengeance. And that speech was private, it was personal, whereas what we read here is like all of David's Psalms, it's meant to be recorded, it's meant to be handed down to posterity. So we need to view this as more of David's final oracle than his last words, in the way we commonly think of somebody's last words. The character and the nature of this song that follows the Psalm of Thanksgiving in chapter 22 has a distinctly more prophetic nature. And even though there are some obvious prophetic parallels in chapter 22's song, it was much more intended as a hymn of praise to the Lord for all of his deliverances and for the many blessings that David had experienced throughout his life. So what we might call the song that begins chapter 23 as a prophetic will and testament of David, it's something that more or less unfolds the significance of David's kingship in relation to the sacred history of the future. For me, one of the most fascinating aspects of this song happens right at its beginning, because whether David intended it or not, and I suspect that he was fully aware of it, this entire song is essentially an expansion of the prophetic oracle given hundreds of years earlier, as it was pronounced by that pagan Gentile seer Balaam in Numbers chapter 24. And we'll start off next week by reading those passages, by the way. And as I think it's going to be demonstrated, what we're going to see is a wonderful and a poignant example of a concept of progressive revelation, as we are going to compare Numbers chapter 24 with this song of David.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.